Chapter 38. What is it that confers the noblest delight? What is that which swells a man's breast with pride above that which any other experience can bring to him? Discovery. To know that you are walking where none others have walked, that you are beholding what human eye has not seen before, that you are breathing a virgin atmosphere. To give birth to an idea, to discover a great thought, an intellectual nugget, right under the dust of a field, that many a brain plow had gone over before. To find a new planet, to invent a new inch, to find the way, to make the lightning's carrier messages. To be the first, that is the idea. To do something, say something, see something, before anybody else, these are the things that confer a pleasure compared with which other pleasures are tame and commonplace, other ecstasies cheap and trivial. Morse, with his first message, brought by his servant, the lightning, Fulton, in that long-drawn century of suspense, when he placed his hand upon the throttle valve and lo, the steamboat moved. Jenner, when his patient with the cow's virus in his blood, walked through the smallpox hospitals unscathed. Howe, when the idea shot through his brain, that for 120 generations the eye had been bored through the wrong end of the needle, the nameless lord of art who laid down his chisel in some old age that is forgotten now, and gloated upon the finished lacoon. Daguerre, when he commanded the sun, writing in the zenith, to print the landscape upon his insignificant silvered plate, and he obeyed. Columbus, in the Pinta's shrouds, when he swung his hat above a fabled sea, and gazed abroad upon an unknown world. These are the men who have really lived, who have actually comprehended what pleasure is, who have crowded long lifetimes of ecstasy into a single moment. What is there in Rome for me to see that others have not seen before me? What is there for me to touch that others have not touched? What is there for me to feel, to learn, to hear, to know, that shall thrill me before it pass to others? What can I discover? Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. One charm of travel dies here. But if I were only a Roman, if, added to my own, I could be gifted with modern Roman sloth, modern Roman superstition, and modern Roman boundlessness of ignorance, what bewildering worlds of unsuspected wonders I would discover. Ah, if I were only a habitant of the Campagna 25 miles from Rome, then I would travel. I would go to America, and see, and learn, and return to the Campagna and stand before my countrymen and illustrious discoverer. I would say, I saw there a country which has no overshadowing Mother Church, and yet the people survive. I saw a government which never was protected by foreign soldiers at a cost greater than that required to carry on the government itself. I saw common men and common women who could read. I even saw small children of common country people reading from books. If I dared, think you would believe it, I would say they could write, also. In the cities I saw people drinking a delicious beverage made of chalk and water, but never once saw goats driven through their Broadway, or their Pennsylvania Avenue, or their Montgomery Street, and milked at the doors of the houses. I saw real glass windows in the houses of even the commonest people. Some of the houses are not of stone, nor yet of bricks. I solemnly swear they are made of wood. Houses there will take fire and burn, sometimes actually burn entirely down, and not leave a single vestige behind. I could state that for a truth, upon my death-bed. And as a proof that the circumstance is not rare, I aver that they have a thing which they call a fire engine, which vomits forth great streams of water, and is kept always in readiness, by night and by day, to rush to houses that are burning. You would think one engine would be sufficient, but some great cities have 100. They keep men hired, and pay them by the month, to do nothing but put out fires. For a certain sum of money other men will ensure that your house shall not burn down, and if it burns they will pay you for it. There are hundreds and thousands of schools, and anybody may go and learn to be wise, like a priest. In that singular country, if a rich man dies a sinner, he is damned. He cannot buy salvation with money for masses. There is really not much use in being rich, there. Not much use as far as the other world is concerned, but much, very much use as concerns this. Because there, if a man be rich, he is very greatly honored, and can become a legislator, a governor, a general, a senator, no matter how ignorant an ass he is. Just as in our beloved Italy the nobles hold all the great places, even though sometimes they are born noble idiots. There, if a man be rich, they give him costly presents, they ask him to feasts, they invite him to drink complicated beverages. But if he be poor and in debt, they require him to do that which they term too edle. The women put on a different dress almost every day. The dress is usually fine, but absurd in shape. The very shape and fashion of it changes twice in 100 years. And did I but covet to be called an extravagant falsifier, I would say it changed even oftener. Hair does not grow upon the American women's heads. It is made for them by cunning workmen in the shops, and is curled and frizzled in two scandalous and ungodly forms. Some persons wear eyes of glass which they see through with facility perhaps, else they would not use them, and in the mouths of some are teeth made by the sacrilegious hand of man. The dress of the men is laughably grotesque. They carry no musket in ordinary life, nor no long pointed pole, they wear no wide green lined cloak. They wear no peaked black felt hat, no leathern gaiters reaching to the knee, no goatskin breeches with the hair side out, no hobnailed shoes, no prodigious spurs. They wear a conical hat termed a ale cag, a coat of saddest black, a shirt which shows dirt so easily that it has to be changed every month, and is very troublesome. Things called pantaloons, which are held up by shoulder straps, and on their feet they wear boots which are ridiculous in pattern, and can stand nowhere. Yet dressed in this fantastic garb, these people laughed at my costume. In that country, books are so common, that it is really no curiosity to see one. Newspapers also. They have a great machine which prints such things by thousands every hour. I saw common men, there men who were neither priests, nor princes who yet absolutely owned the land they tilled. It was not rented from the church, nor from the nobles. I am ready to take my oath of this. In that country you might fall from a third-story window 3 several times, and not mash either a soldier or a priest. The scarcity of such people is astonishing. In the cities you will see a dozen civilians for every soldier, and as many for every priest or preacher. Jews, there, are treated just like human beings, instead of dogs. They can work at any business they please, they can sell brand new goods, if they want to, they can keep drug stores, they can practice medicine among Christians, they can even shake hands with Christians if they choose, they can associate with them. Just the same as one human being does with another human being. They don't have to stay shut up in one corner of the towns. They can live in any part of a town they like best. It is said they even have the privilege of buying land and houses, and owning them themselves, though I doubt that, myself. They never have had to run races naked through the public streets, against jackasses, to please the people in carnival time. There they never have been driven by the soldiers into a church every Sunday for hundreds of years, to hear themselves and their religion especially and particularly cursed. At this very day, in that curious country, a Jew is allowed to vote, hold office, yea, get up on the rostrum in the public street, and express his opinion of the government, if the government don't suit him. Ah, it is wonderful. The common people there know a great deal. They even have the effrontery to complain, if they are not properly governed, and to take hold and help conduct the government themselves. If they had laws like ours, which give $1 of every 3 a crop produces to the government for taxes, they would have that law altered. Instead of paying $33 in taxes, out of every 100 they receive, they complain if they have to pay 7. They are curious people. They do not know when they are well off. Mendicant priests do not prowl among them with baskets begging for the church and eating up their substance. One hardly ever sees a minister of the gospel going around there in his bare feet, with a basket, begging for subsistence. In that country the preachers are not like our mendicant orders of friars. They have two or three suits of clothing, and they wash sometimes. In that land are mountains far higher than the Alban Mountains, the vast Roman Campagna, 100 miles long and full 40 broad, is really small compared to the United States of America. The Tiber, that celebrated river of ours, which stretches its mighty course almost 200 miles, and which a lad can scarcely throw a stone across at Rome, is not so long, nor yet so wide, as the American Mississippi, nor yet the Ohio, nor even the Hudson. In America the people are absolutely wiser, and know much more than their grandfathers did. They do not plow with a sharpened stick, nor yet with a three-cornered block of wood, that merely scratches the top of the ground. We do that, because our fathers did, 3,000 years ago, I suppose. But those people have no holy reverence for their ancestors. They plow with a plow, that is a sharp, curved blade of iron, and it cuts into the earth full 5 inches. And this is not all. They cut their grain with a horrid machine that mows down whole fields in a day. If I dared, I would say that sometimes they use a blasphemous plow that works by fire and vapor and tears up an acre of ground in a single hour. But I see by your looks that you do not believe the things I am telling you. Alas, my character is ruined, and I am a branded speaker of untruths. Of course we have been to the monster church of St. Peter, frequently. I knew its dimensions. I knew it was a prodigious structure. I knew it was just about the length of the Capitol at Washington, say 730 feet. I knew it was 364 feet wide, and consequently wider than the Capitol. I knew that the cross on the top of the dome of the church was 438 feet above the ground, and therefore about 100, or maybe 125 feet higher than the dome of the Capitol. Thus I had one gauge. I wished to come as near forming a correct idea of how it was going to look as possible. I had a curiosity to see how much I would err. I erred considerably. St. Peter's did not look nearly so large as the Capitol, and certainly not a 20th part as beautiful, from the outside. When we reached the door, and stood fairly within the church, it was impossible to comprehend that it was a very large building. I had to cipher a comprehension of it. I had to ransack my memory for some more similes. St. Peter's is bulky. Its height and size would represent two of the Washington Capitol set one on top of the other if the Capitol were wider, or two blocks or two blocks, and a half of ordinary buildings set one on top of the other. St. Peter's was that large, but it could and would not look so. The trouble was that everything in it and about it was on such a scale of uniform vastness that there were no contrasts to judge by, none but the people, and I had not noticed them. They were insects. The statues of children holding vases of holy water were immense, according to the tables of figures, but so was everything else around them. The mosaic pictures in the dome were huge, and were made of thousands and thousands of cubes of glass as large as the end of my little finger, but those pictures looked smooth, and gaudy of color, and in good proportion to the dome. Evidently they would not answer to measure by. Away down toward the far end of the church, I thought it was really clear at the far end, but discovered afterward that it was in the center, under the dome, stood the thing they call the baldacchino, a great bronze pyramidal framework like that which upholds a mosquito bar. It only looked like a considerably magnified bedstead, nothing more. Yet I knew it was a good deal more than half as high as Niagara Falls. It was overshadowed by a dome so mighty that its own height was snubbed. The four great square piers or pillars that stand equidistant from each other in the church and support the roof, I could not work up to their real dimensions by any method of comparison. I knew that the faces of each were about the width of a very large dwelling house front, 50 or 60 feet, and that they were twice as high as an ordinary three-story dwelling. But still they looked small. I tried all the different ways I could think of to compel myself to understand how large St. Peter's was, but with small success. The mosaic portrait of an apostle who was writing with a pen 6 feet long seemed only an ordinary apostle. But the people attracted my attention after a while. To stand in the door of St. Peter's and look at men down toward its further extremity, 2 blocks away, has a diminishing effect on them, surrounded by the prodigious pictures and statues, and lost in the vast spaces. They look very much smaller than they would if they stood 2 blocks away in the open air. I verged a man as he passed me, and watched him as he drifted far down by the baldacchino, and beyond watched him dwindle to an insignificant schoolboy, and then, in the midst of the silent throng of human pygmies gliding about him, I lost him. The church had lately been decorated, on the occasion of a great ceremony in honor of St. Peter, and men were engaged, now, in removing the flowers and gilt paper from the walls and pillars. As no ladders could reach the great heights, the men swung themselves down from balustrades, and the capitals of pilasters by ropes, to do this work. The upper gallery, which encircles the inner sweep of the dome, is 240 feet above the floor of the church. Very few steeples in America could reach up to it. Visitors always go up there to look down into the church, because one gets the best idea of some of the heights and distances from that point. While we stood on the floor, one of the workmen swung loose from that gallery at the end of a long rope. I had not supposed, before, that a man could look so much like a spider. He was insignificant in size, and his rope seemed only a thread. Seeing that he took up so little space, I could believe the story then, that 10,000 troops went to St. Peter's, once, to hear Mass, and their commanding officer came afterward, and not finding them, supposed they had not yet arrived. But they were in the church, nevertheless they were in one of the transepts. Nearly 50,000 persons assembled in St. Peter's, to hear the publishing of the dogma of the Immaculate Conception. It is estimated that the floor of the church affords standing room for a large number of people. I have forgotten the exact figures, but it is no matter, it is near enough. They have 12 small pillars in St. Peter's, which came from Solomon's temple. They have, also, which was far more interesting to me, a piece of the true cross, and some nails, and a part of the crown of thorns. Of course we ascended to the summit of the dome, and of course we also went up into the gilt copper ball which is above it. There was room there for a dozen persons, with a little crowding, and it was as close and hot as an oven. Some of those people who are so fond of writing their names in prominent places had been there before us a million or two, I should think. From the dome of St. Peter's one can see every notable object in Rome, from the castle of St. Angelo to the Colosseum. He can discern the 7 hills upon which Rome is built. He can see the Tiber, and the locality of the bridge which Horatius kept in the brave days of old, when Lars Porsena attempted to cross it with his invading host. He can see the spot where the Herodii and the Curatii fought their famous battle. He can see the broad green Campagna, stretching away toward the mountains, with its scattered arches and broken aqueducts of the olden time, so picturesque in their gray ruin, and so daintily festooned with vines. He can see the Alban Mountains, the Apennines, the Sabine Hills, and the blue Mediterranean. He can see a panorama that is varied, extensive, beautiful to the eye, and more lustrous in history than any other in Europe. About his feet is spread the remnant of a city that once had a population of 4 million souls, and among its massed edifices stand the ruins of temples, columns, and triumphal arches that knew the Caesars and the noonday of Roman splendor, and close by them, in an impaired strength, is a drain of arched and heavy masonry that belonged to that older city which stood here before Romulus and Remus were born, or Rome thought of. The Appian Way is here yet, and looking much as it did, perhaps, when the triumphal processions of the emperors moved over it in other days, bringing fettered princes from the confines of the earth. We cannot see the long array of chariots and mail-clad men laden with the spoils of conquest, but we can imagine the pageant, after a fashion. We look out upon many objects of interest from the dome of St. Peter's, and last of all, almost at our feet, our eyes rest upon the building which was once the Inquisition. How times changed, between the older ages and the new. Some 17 or 18 centuries ago, the ignorant men of Rome were wont to put Christians in the arena of the Colosseum yonder, and turn the wild beasts in upon them for a show. It was for a lesson as well. It was to teach the people to abhor and fear the new doctrine the followers of Christ were teaching. The beasts tore the victims limb from limb, and made poor mangled corpses of them in the twinkling of an eye. But when the Christians came into power, when the Holy Mother Church became mistress of the barbarians, she taught them the error of their ways by no such means. No, she put them in this pleasant Inquisition, and pointed to the blessed Redeemer, who was so gentle, and so merciful toward all men, and they urged the barbarians to love him, and they did all they could to persuade them to love and honor him first, by twisting their thumbs out of joint with a screw, then by nipping their flesh with pincers, red-hot ones, because they are the most comfortable in cold weather, then by skinning them alive a little, and finally by roasting them in public. They always convinced those barbarians. The true religion, properly administered, as the good Mother Church used to administer it, is very, very soothing. It is wonderfully persuasive. Also, there is a great difference between feeding parties to wild beasts and stirring up their finer feelings in an inquisition. One is the system of degraded barbarians, the other of enlightened, civilized people. It is a great pity the playful inquisition is no more. I prefer not to describe St. Peter's. It has been done before. The ashes of Peter, the disciple of the Savior, repose in a crypt under the Baldacchino. We stood reverently in that place, so did we also in the Mamertine prison, where he was confined, where he converted the soldiers, and where tradition says he caused a spring of water to flow in order that he might baptize them. But when they showed us the print of Peter's face in the hard stone of the prison wall, and said he made that by Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.